You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard LoPate on this lovely Monday afternoon. It may be hard to believe, but Google is almost a teenager. And like many 12-year-olds, the giant company is going through some awkward changes. Since Google started in 1998, it has become so much a part of our lives and our culture that the word has quickly become a verb. And over the past few years, with piles of cash generated by its ad searches, Google has expanded its empire, purchasing YouTube and the digital marketing giant DoubleClick and creating the Droid technology for mobile phones. The company is still bringing in double-digit growth, yet over the past year, its stock has dropped 21%. All of this is the subject of an article in the latest issue of Fortune magazine. And joining us by phone today to talk about why Google is no longer the darling it once was is Fortune's senior technology writer Michael V. Copeland. Copeland, along with Seth Weintraub, is author of Fortune's new cover story, Google, The Search Party is Over. Also joining us by phone is Stephanie Mehta, executive editor at Fortune, where she oversees technology, international, and policy coverage. Welcome, Stephanie and Michael.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Michael, Google is projected to have an 18% earnings growth this year, something you write about other companies would kill for. Why is that a disappointment for Google?
Well, for Google, I mean, we're used to seeing, you know, growth rates and earnings double that or even more than double that. And so when you compare their growth rate that's projected for this year to the past 5 years, it's half of what Google averaged over the past 5 years. So if you're an investor looking at that, you're wondering, where did all the growth go?
But is this, Stephanie, a kind of trajectory that you'd expect from a company? I mean, 12 years is a long time to be doing the same thing and having that kind of extraordinary growth. So when people analyze companies, do they look and say, well, yeah, it's becoming a teenager?
Absolutely, and that's what Michael points out in his story, that there are lots of great technology companies and companies that continue to be mainstays of our work and business lives that have gone through this same kind of growing pain, whether it's Microsoft or eBay or some of the other, you know, sort of big brand names in technology. But you know, Google has always been a little special, and I think that people who work at Google and people who use Google and people who've come to expect great things of Google felt that this company had the potential to keep that growth trajectory going for a bit longer. And again, I'll let Michael talk a little bit about this, but you know, Google is often mentioned in the same breath as Apple. And Apple's a great example of a company that has managed to find new sources of revenue and to find new ways to grow. And so I think the question that he tries to raise in the story, and one that, you know, many investors are asking is, you know, what's Google's next act?
Well, and you raise an interesting point. And Michael, I'd like to ask you about that.
Sure.
Stephanie, you say that Google considered itself a little special. Michael, why did Google think that it was special, that it could avoid this kind of tradition of...
Well, you go down to Google and you wander around the campus and, you know, people are playing volleyball, they're outside in the sunshine, you know, the sort of... The idea that Google could take on and do anything from energy to, you know, technology was kind of permeates this campus down there. And so there's this belief and you know, there's a whole lot of very smart people who kind of have this, you know, idea that, you know, if they put their minds to it, they can do anything. And so you have this culture of optimism, really. And I think we all believe that, too. But all these projects, they have this famous sort of 20% work rule, where 20% of your work day can be devoted to projects that you just find interesting. And certainly some interesting things have come out of that, Google Sky, which is kind of a celestial view of the universe and other things. But those kind of googly interesting projects haven't translated to money and to a next big engine of growth. And so, you know, I think if we thought Google could solve every problem and take on whatever it wanted, we aren't actually seeing the results of that, and it may just not be true.
Well, it sounds like Google might be able to look at new problems and come up with some extraordinary solutions, but as you say, they're just not something that's going to make them money.
Right. You know, it's funny. I was down at Google in the course of reporting this story, and some of what Google does were actually referred to as parlor tricks, whether that's kind of translation where you can hold your phone, you know, you can speak in Japanese, well, you can speak in English into a phone and ask it to speak back to somebody in Japanese. And that's all very cool, and that requires, you know, massive amounts of computing and massive amounts of brain power. But at the end of the day, it's a little bit of a parlor trick, right?
And although it could be useful, but I guess the question then is, how do you make money off of something like that?
Exactly. And Google hasn't really found a good way to make money off of some of these really sort of fantastic things that they do that yet don't really translate to money. The vast majority of their revenue and the even more of their profits, so maybe 93 to 97% of their revenue, depending on how you count it, and up to 99% of their profits still comes from search and search-related advertising via what they call AdWords and AdSense.
Stephanie, you mentioned Apple, which you have a lovely graph in this article where you see what Apple's growth has been over the past year and then what Google's growth has been over the past year, and they diverge quite dramatically. And Apple is a company that did reinvent itself, but not without some stumbles along the way. Is that, do you think, a kind of case study for Google to look at to say there are other ways we're going to be able to increase our bottom line?
Well, I think you're right in pointing out that Apple certainly had its share of struggles, and you know, Steve Jobs was asked to leave the company. He came back to the company, and you know, even at the start of the second Steve Jobs reign at Apple, there were many rough years, and you know, they had to take money from Microsoft. So, you know, in some ways, one could argue that they've had some challenges that they've had to work through that has made the company stronger, and perhaps that's not something that Google has yet had to encounter and could still, you know, end up being part of their story as well. But to your question about, you know, reinventing themselves, Apple has clearly found new lines of business that can be strong contributors to its top line as well as its bottom line. It essentially reinvented the mobile phone business. It essentially, you know, helped reinvent now the way people engage in personal computing with its iPad and with tablets. And part of it is because Apple is more of a product-driven company, so they can roll out new products. It's not exactly an analogy to Google, but as Michael was talking about the sort of googly experimentation, you know, the one Google experiment, and I'm got air quotes that I'm doing, that has panned out very well is Android. It is a mobile operating system, and they have not gone after an aggressive monetization policy for Android by choice. They have this great product. It's growing at a tremendous rate. There are something like 160,000 Android-based phones that are activated every day worldwide, and yet the entire business model for Android is not specifically to make money on licensing, but rather to advance the cause of mobile search. So they
give it away in order to, I mean, it's sort of like,
yeah.
I guess it's different from the razor blades. They don't give away the razor to me, but it's similar in that you then use it to do the searches, which goes to their search numbers, those huge numbers, Michael, that you were just talking about most of their profit comes from their major business.
Right. And mobile search, it's interesting because we're talking about Apple. Steve Jobs recently sort of he explicitly said that what they're seeing with the iPhone and Apple's iPhone OS is that searches go down on these smartphones, on these really advanced mobile phones that we have. And so there's some question that, Steve Jobs would argue that mobile is much different than the desktop world, you know, laptop world that Google dominates. And so, you know, even if Android has this huge success, which it does, you know, it's an open question as to whether that translates to the same kind of revenue that, you know, desktop search has thus far for Google.
I'm speaking with Michael V. Copeland, the writer, and Stephanie Mehta, executive editor at Fortune magazine. And Fortune has a new issue with a cover article called Google, The Search Party is Over. I want to stay with this idea of Apple and Google for a moment and also bring in Microsoft, because one of the things when I look at both of these things, I mean, Google is so incredibly useful, but in terms of design, it's never been the place to go to be able to see something beautiful. Apple has cornered that design market, or maybe not cornered it, but definitely design is a key piece of what they do. And Microsoft with Bing has come out with something that visually is beautiful. So it's a site where you want to go just to look at the picture before you go and do a search. Is that something that's, Michael, infiltrating Google culture, where they're starting to think about those pieces as well?
Well, sure. I mean, a couple of weeks back, a month ago, they did this Bing-like photo page on the landing page of Google Search. So usually you have this, you know, very sterile white box at Google.com. And for one day, they had this photo that was very Bing-like. And they were certainly trying it out. And I think they got a lot of angry kind of messages from some Google lovers, and they took it down after a day. But they're certainly trying different things, and some people would argue they're trying Bing-like things. So Google knows that the search game, its bread and butter, is changing. And Bing is one of the reasons. Bing, you know, Bing's pretty good, and Bing's gaining market share, you know, and that's the first search engine in years that has done something like that. So, you know, it's not big yet, and it's certainly, I don't know how big of a concern it is to Google at this point, but if it keeps growing, it will be.
Well, you note in your article, and I know there's an article in today's Times, too, that they've gone from Bing has gone from 12.1% to 12.7% of the search market, which seems like a little bit, but I guess that is growth. And Stephanie, as you're talking about, do you think competition is something that is essential in a way for a company to be able to innovate?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that and people at Google would I'd say, at least on the surface, say we welcome the competition. I think it's interesting because, as Michael's article points out, the competition is partly coming from Bing, but it's also coming from this changing way we use the web, and I think that's much more significant. You know, it's not the direct competition where it's, you know, I'm making the choice between Bing and Google. It's really, I think, this broader way in which consumers are reinventing the way they use the web. And it's me now making the choice between doing a Google search for, you know, the best camps to send your kids to in the summer and posting something on my Twitter feed or posting a status update on Facebook and just getting my friends to tell me the best camps to send my kids to. So there's a whole different way people are interacting with the web, and I think that's Google's real competition, and that's what's going to force them to innovate. It's not trying to build a better search engine. It's trying to build a better web experience.
I'm speaking with Stephanie Maida and Michael Copeland from Fortune magazine about their cover story, Is Google Over? We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. We'll talk a little bit more about this whole idea of social networking in a moment. Later on in the show, the two directors of a new documentary called 12th and Delaware, about one particular intersection in Florida where two very different sides of the abortion rights battle are juxtaposed. Plus, later in the show, you may never apply cosmetics in the same way again after you hear our segment about what's actually in them. I'm Julie Burstein, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the New York Review of Books, a journal of ideas whose current issue includes Frank Rich on Barack Obama, George Soros on the Euro, and Tim Parks on the shame of the World Cup, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at nybooks.com. Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for individuals, families, and institutions seeking advice, generation after generation. More information available at glennmead.com.
What's the best advice you can give about raising children?
I think any parent, if they want to be good parents, fall in love with your kids.
Hi, I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. What advice do you have for future generations? Come share it with someone you love at our booth in Foley Square. Make a reservation on the events page at WNYC.org or by calling 1-800-850-4406. And listen here on Fridays for more conversations from StoryCorps.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Michael V. Copeland and Stephanie Maida from Fortune magazine about the cover article, Google, The Search Party is Over. Stephanie, just before the break, you talked about the different ways people are searching for things. And Michael, you get into that in your article. How do you see the way that people use the web affecting Google's core business of search?
Well, the thing is that there are sort of substitutions for a kind of a keyword search. And one of the examples we give in the story is the example of James Buck, who was a graduate student in journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. And he was doing his thesis in Egypt and was covering some protests outside of Cairo and taking pictures that that the police in Cairo did not approve of, I gather. And so he was arrested. And so he is being driven to a police station, and he uses Twitter, and he tweets out to his network one word, and it was arrested. And within 24 hours, actually less than that, but within hours, the University of California officials were notified. A lawyer was sent. The State Department sort of met them all at the police station. And within 24 hours, James Buck was released from jail, and that was with one word. So in a sense, you know, so try doing that with a Google keyword search for starters. And what it implies and what has happened is that his network sort of he needed help or he needed something to occur, and his network solved his problem for him. And that's a much different kind of dynamic and a different relationship with technology and kind of the people and the connections that we have than you can do via Google. And what that means is that more and more people are spending time, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn, you know, applications, apps like Yelp, other things, they're spending more and more of their time there, and they're relying on it more and more for answers to questions than they are on Google. And so if people spend more time in these places and they're more focused, and for example, if Facebook knows a lot about what I like and what I don't like, or Twitter for that matter, advertisers are following those people to those places too. And so what you're seeing is, and in many cases those advertisers are Google's advertisers. So you're seeing as the people migrate and spend their time to other things in the social kind of web world, advertisers are following them too. And for Google, ultimately that could be a big problem, especially if companies like Facebook with massive scale start serving up their own ads, which you can imagine them doing.
You know, as I read that story, and Stephanie, as you told the story about searching for a camp for your kids, it doesn't seem like it's an either or, that you only would send out the word arrested and then nobody would be doing Google searches or searches of any kind on the other end. So I have two questions. One is search going down? And the other is, are these other entities like Facebook and Twitter going to enter the world of Google so that if you send out that word arrested, then somehow through Twitter you'll be able to do your searches and you won't need Google anymore?
Well, I'll let Michael address some of this because I think that you know, his reporting would bear out that, you know, you're right, it's not either or. I do think that, you know, search is not – people aren't going to stop searching, but it's not going to continue to grow at the rates that it has been growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a part of our story is about the slowing of the growth. It's not about the fact that, you know, Google is going away or that, you know, this company is dead. It's just that the growth trajectory that has propelled them forward and made them a growth stock for so many years is starting to slow. And there's no question that people have many, many more choices available to them as consumers and increasingly in their business lives now for how they get information and how they organize and sort that information.
And it sounds like the advertisers have many more choices as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And many more, perhaps more compelling and engaging choices. I mean, Google's great breakthrough, of course, was that it delivered relevant ads. I'm searching for camp. So the advertisements on the side are all related to, you know, kids programs and summer camps. So they're getting me while I'm vulnerable, and they're getting me when I'm trying to meet a need. But, you know, with Facebook, they have a ton of contextual information. So not only do they know that I'm looking for camps, but they know that I'm, you know, a 40-year-old woman and that I live north of Manhattan and that I sometimes tweet about the independent rock music I like to listen to.
Right.
And so now they've got all that information on me, and the advertiser can deliver a really almost one-to-one kind of marketing.
And they may
experience.
Even know, you know, I'm just guessing, but they may know the age of your child because your child has a Facebook account too.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, there's all kinds of privacy issues associated with that, but let's assume I've opted in. Let's assume that I'm all in and I view this as a utility and I want the advertising. So if that's all, if we're all on the same page, you know, I may find that Facebook or Twitter or Groupon, which is another company Michael mentions in his story, you know, those avenues may be better suited to reach me.
I mean, one point I would make is that, yes, search is not going away. So if you use the example of a camp, you might ask your network, you know, your friends on Facebook or your Twitter followers, you know, what's the best camp to send my child to, and get that answer. If you're looking for the phone number for the camp, you would still use Google, right?
So right, or Bing. I mean, or
right.
Yahoo or wherever you use. Yeah,
yeah. So that kind of utilitarian, you know, use of search isn't going away. And I would stress that what Google's really good at is this kind of utility. I mean, it's sort of the power company of the internet. You know, you can get email, you can get, you know, messaging, calendar, and you can get search. Where it hasn't been very good historically is the kind of social side, figuring out how to connect people and how they collaborate. And it's had some sort of public and, you know, embarrassing failures in that regard with Google Buzz, where they had a revolt about all these, you know, everybody's all of a sudden their private contacts were made public to all sorts of people without really Google asking. So, you know, search is not going away. The question is, can Google move into this social arena? Because clearly that social arena is moving into Google's business. I mean, Facebook the other day launched something called Facebook Questions, and very literally, it's, you know, ask a question of, you know, your network on Facebook. And if that's not kind of a substitution for search, I don't know what is. Twitter has the same search kind of mechanism going on. They've hired plenty of ex-Google people who worked on search to work on their search at Twitter. So clearly they think that what their search, which is this kind of stream of what's going on now, you know, if people want to search the kind of the zeitgeist of the moment, they're going to try and do it on Twitter. They want them to search, you know, and get results that also are a substitution for Google search.
I'm speaking with Michael Copeland and Stephanie Maida from Fortune magazine about their cover story, Is Google Over? Michael, you do talk about Facebook, and you talk about this idea, this question that people have, is there something called Google Me? Can you tell us a little bit about what that is? I mean, I do know people who Google themselves, but this is different, right?
Yeah, this is different. Clearly Google is working on something to sort of knit together its properties with, you know, a social layer. I was talking with Marissa Mayer, who is the head of search at Google. And, you know, we've had in the last couple of days, Google, Eric Schmidt, made some announcement or implied that they're going to be working with social gaming companies like Zynga, and others to sort of bring, you know, all these, you know, kind of casual games and all the people who play them to Google. So kind of bring the playground to Google so people can hang out. That's part of it. I think, you know, what you're going to find in the end and what Google will try to do, and this is kind of from my discussions with Marissa Mayer, is that, you know, let's say you do a search, you're planning a trip to Australia is the example I give in the story, and you have friends who may live in Australia who are experts on travel in Australia, and so as you're doing that search, you could pull down messages or emails that you've had with those friends who know about Australia. You could pose a question to those friends about the best place to stay in Australia or the best, you know, beachside resort to go to. And so what it'll try and do is, you know, consider your context, your friends, and what you're trying to accomplish, and then kind of bring this social layer around all that and give you the right answer and probably the right ad, too, at the same time.
I have to say, when I hear all of this, it starts feeling a little creepy. I know, Stephanie, you mentioned that, too. It's like, I'm not sure I want a company to know this much about me so that it'll know my friends in Australia and have them start talking to me about something. Are there a lot of people who are looking at this saying, I don't know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, clearly there are a bunch of privacy issues, and, you know, Facebook has certainly experienced its fair share of backlash from users who feel like the company has gone too far or not done enough to disclose how much information is public versus how much information is private. I mean, at the end of the day, and it's a terrible thing to say, but, you know, I think most consumers, there's a big dose of caveat emptor involved in using social networks. The fact is you're broadcasting or transmitting information, and, you know, at best you can manage your privacy settings so that perhaps only a small group of your friends see that information. But, you know, at the end of the day, you are consenting to a certain amount of your information being held onto by these entities, whether it's a Facebook or a Twitter, particularly on these social networks. And you know, if you don't want to be marketed to online, you probably shouldn't be online.
Well, and this is true. Even I have Gmail, and I know I'm writing a book, and when I write to my publisher, occasionally I'll get those little ads on the right-hand side saying, do you want to self-publish your book? And I'm thinking, this is in the email that I'm writing. So yeah. it's not broadcast, but Google is looking at that and saying, oh, she must be interested in books. So it happens everywhere. But I wanted to get back to the idea of business, because that is what you really are focused on in this story. And one of the things, Michael, that you look at is the other businesses that that Google has acquired, like YouTube, which now, I can't remember the figures, it's something like 10% of all time spent online is spent on YouTube?
Yeah, it's a massive and massively growing. The only other larger time suck, as it were, is Facebook. So people
which is like
17%. 17%, yeah. So, but YouTube is growing and growing massively. The ding against YouTube all along was until very recently was that it was the biggest nonprofit, video site in Google's collection. But it is now turning a small profit, and Google announced a couple months ago Google TV, and clearly video for Google is a big target for advertising. And, you know, their display ad business, you know, these kind of snappier, more graphically intensive, you know, they oftentimes contain video ads, are doing pretty well on YouTube. And, you know, the combination of display ads and YouTube and kind of bringing a higher-end, higher-price-tag advertising product to YouTube and sort of video online generally could be a big winner for Google.
When you were out there, Michael, what were the things that you saw that you thought, all right, this is something that might lead to that next thing for Google? Was there anything that you encountered that you experienced as, oh, this could be as game-changing as the search that they came up with?
Yes and no. So I think YouTube and display ads are a huge growth area. Display ads, as opposed to sort of this text search that goes along with, you know, our online keyword searching, is a market that's much smaller and kind of much more fractured. So Google wants to try and gather up as much of that as it can. And so that's one big area. Android, as Stephanie mentioned, is growing massively. The question is, can mobile search and some of the advertising that might associate with mobile really replace or get to the level of desktop search? There's Google Apps, which is a sort of, you know, all these online applications that compete with Microsoft Office, frankly. And, you know, that's growing, but that's not making Google a lot of money really either. And those are sort of the – between YouTube, Android, Google Apps, and then – the display ad business. Those are kind of the four main areas that could really provide some engines of growth for Google. But the problem is, if you're looking at Google as a company, you know, the margins in all those other areas are nowhere near what they are in Google's traditional core search business, which margins are kind of 70%. So that's massive. And so these other businesses, as fast growing as they are, and they are growing fast relative to Google's core business, they have to become very, very, very large, because their margins are a good deal smaller for them to really make up a difference in terms of Google's revenue.
I'm curious, and Stephanie, you may be able to answer this. A margin of 70% seems huge. Are there other industries where you can find that kind of margin on a product?
You know, it's very rare. I mean, I think at one point, and I'd really have to double check on this, but I think at one point, you know, Cisco, for example, was seeing margins comparable to that on certain products in its portfolio, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, these were products they had been building for years and years and years and years, and so, you know, for them to make big profits, you know, it was based on the fact that this was a product that had been in their pipeline for a long time. But it's not typical, and part of why Google is sort of has always been a source of fascination for those of us in the business press is because, you know, they really are a pure intellectual property company. I mean, they can garner those kinds of margins because, you know, they don't have a manufacturing facility. They don't have, you know, unions on their payroll that they have to think about in terms of pensions and all. You know, it's just it's a very different model. It is the company of the future. It's all about intellectual brawn. And you can get margins like that on a product when, you know, you don't have manufacturing facilities and you're not, you know, worried about inventory and things like that.
And you don't even, except now with YouTube, have to reinvent things and create stories. You create something that then people use and need to continue to use.
Right. I mean, it is the original sort of user-generated product, and its utility grew as more people used it. You know, but that said, I think that, as Michael has pointed out, you know, where they go from here is a really interesting and nagging question. And perhaps, you know, it's not so much that they get out of the search business or that they reduce their emphasis on search. It's that search becomes something else. I mean, I think that that's really the key is that, you know, they may in the future continue to be primarily a search company, but how we look at search and how they look at search may change.
And they may need to figure that out.
The one thing I should point out, too, is that, you know, for all their success in search, and, you know, it's sort of, depending on whose number you believe, but it's 70% kind of worldwide, in some places 90%. They, even if they want to get into new businesses, and we mentioned, you know, four or five, antitrust sort of radar is just buzzing, you know, around Google. And so every time they try and get into something new, there's the question of whether, you know, a government around the world will allow them. So they have that to go up against, too.
Well, and that, you know, this is, we just have a moment, but a caller asked, are these companies getting too big? Is that something that could happen with a company like Google?
I think that's a fair question. I mean, do you want Google to really provide everything on the internet? And, you know, if you're an advertiser, I know there's been complaints in the past about, well, really my only avenue of advertising is now Google, and Google gets to set the price, gets to sort of determine, you know, my success or, you know, conversely, my failure. And, you know, a lot of people get nervous about really being beholden for their livelihoods only to Google. So, you know, that's a fair question, and it's one that's, you know, remains unanswered thus far.
Well, I've been speaking with Michael Copeland and Stephanie Maida from Fortune magazine about their cover story, Is Google Over? Thanks to both of you for being with me today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us.